We're checking in on the off-the-charts number of people, patients, being treated at hospitals in northern, western, and central Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hospitals face staffing crunches. Beds are full. Marshfield Clinic Health System has 9 hospitals, more than 50 locations, and dozens of communities. Are you a frontline healthcare worker? What do you need now to fight COVID? What questions do you have about the virus spread and what happens next? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. William Melms is Chief Medical Officer for Marshfield Clinic Health System. Dr. Melms, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
What is the current status of your hospitals? What can you tell us?
Well, let me start by giving you some perspective about where we're at by telling you where we came from. If in our hospitals, we have 9 hospitals spread across the rural parts of the state. We have three of those hospitals are critical access hospitals. If we go back just 2 months the same day in September, we had 12 patients in all of our hospitals. Last week, we had 100. Yesterday, we had 141. If we look across the state over that same period of time, we've seen an increase in hospitalizations of over 640%, with an increase in ICU utilization of over 450%. We are at a crisis point here with hospital census and COVID patients.
Are you having to divert patients? Are your beds full?
Our beds, this is a very dynamic process. So our beds will be full at times. We will do everything we can to discharge those patients who are appropriately ready for discharge. We open up patients, our ERs fill up, and we fill those beds up once again. There was a report from the day before yesterday in northwestern Wisconsin that there were 0 ICU beds available. Yesterday, I think there were 2 beds. These are very dynamic, as I say. And
sure,
what we try to do with ICU beds is move patients down to lower acuity levels as soon as we possibly can. As far as diverting patients, we certainly do everything we can to not divert patients. We really don't have places to divert patients to. We just need to make room.
You need to make room. I'm wondering, how is your staff holding up? We've heard of hundreds of staffers sidelined due to needing to quarantine, testing positive.
At any one point, I would say that we keep kind of close tabs on this. About 15% of our frontline workforce is out. And those employees are out either because they are sick themselves or they've had exposures, particularly exposures at home and out in the community.
And when you say 15%, what does that mean? I mean, who are those? Are they nurses? Are they physicians? Who are these 15%?
All of the above. Everyone that has participated, well, not just our frontline staff, but I mean, all of our staff, because really the incidence of COVID in our communities is so high. Our staff are not just healthcare workers. They're also members of the community. So we see those numbers cut across throughout our entire staff.
Where are you looking to help fill in when you don't have enough staff to cover a shift? What do you do?
Well, we're doing a variety of things. First of all, our inpatient staff, they're working more. They're working more shifts. They're working longer shifts. And then what we are doing as our next layer of intervention is we are asking our staff that normally works on the outpatient side to step up and work on the inpatient side. We have sought outside agency staff. We have been able to sign some agency staff, but because surging is really going on across the country now, agency staff is just not as available. You know, back
in
April.
When you say agency staff, explain what you mean by that.
So agency staff, this would be nurses, respiratory therapists, for instance, that they work for a staffing agency. They mm-hmm. may live outside of the state of Wisconsin. We contract with the agency. They send the staff to come up to work for us.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Melms, Chief Medical Officer for the Marshfield Clinic Health System, learning how its system with about 12,000 staff is doing in the pandemic, taking your questions. How do we stop the spread of the virus? How do you convince your friends and neighbors to stay safe? And what happens next? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Melms, what is different here than what New York City faced early in the spring?
Well, back in April, when New York City was facing what they were facing, there was not the pandemic surge elsewhere across the country to the same extent. So they were able to ask for help from around the country. And in fact, we had workers from Marshfield go to New York to help out. And we were very proud of the fact that they did. And as we were watching that, we were certainly not anywhere near surging in Wisconsin. The cases were very rare in Wisconsin, at least in our part of the state. So we thought, as we watched that, that if and when it came our turn, then we would be able to get those staff from around the country. And unfortunately, that just has not been the case at this point.
You can't reciprocate in the situation where so many parts of the country are needing that staffing, have hospitals full.
Correct.
So when you do get staffers in who haven't worked on that floor, who are new to your system, how do they acclimate and get up to speed very, very quickly to work the floor to kind of bring into the fold, if you will, what's happening, on that floor?
Well, it's somewhat variable. These staff generally are very familiar with the concept of having to be flexible, of having to learn a new system quickly. So really, for the most part, the staff that we get in are very good. And our staff are certainly appreciative of that staff coming in. So they are more than willing to help teach. The staff sometimes is variable. Not all of the staff is quite to that level of competency and engagement.
There have been reports in North Dakota allowing asymptomatic healthcare staffers work in that situation. Are you nearing that? What do you think of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a very good question. And I also saw that a nurses union in North Dakota has protested against that. And I'm not sure if that's going to continue or not. But it's certainly in the cards. I think everything is on the table at this point. Really, we may very well have to get to a much deeper levels of intervention here. We really have to look at this and say that it would be magical thinking to believe that our hospitalizations are not going to continue to rise. As we see the new patients' cases rise in Wisconsin every day, those cases become hospitalized patients. We will continue to increase the number of patients in our hospital. We are at or over capacity at this point. 2 weeks from now, 4 weeks from now, we could be overwhelmed.
We have Marshfield Clinic Health System Chief Medical Officer Bill Melms. He's a family practice physician. He's giving us a window into how the 9 hospitals in his system are inundated with COVID patients and what they're doing to handle the surge. What comes next? You can join in. What can you tell us about the pandemic? Are you an essential frontline worker? What do you need now? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Bill Melms here on the Ideas Network. We're checking in on Wisconsin's increasingly dire COVID situation, what hospitals face. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The state's chief medical officer with the Department of Health Services, Dr. Ryan Westergaard, says we're close to a tipping point. At yesterday's briefing, he said hospitals are strained and will run out of staff before they run out of physical space.
We've heard there are some hospitals that have no ICU beds available as of today. So it's a matter of degrees. There are likely areas right now where hospitals have to go on divert and cannot accept patients that they normally would.
Are you a frontline healthcare worker? What can you report? 800-642-1234. Dr. Bill Melms is Chief Medical Officer for Marshfield Clinic Health System, and he stays with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take a call now. Melissa is joining us from Northern Wisconsin and is an emergency room nurse. Hi, Melissa. What would you like to say?
Hi. I was just wondering. I don't work for Marshall, but I work for a different health system. And we are expected, if we become sick or we have to be tested for COVID, we have to be tested, and we're off work while we're awaiting test results. But if our test results come back positive, we are still expected to come to work as long as we feel able to. And, you know, I have two small kids. They can't go to school and they can't go to daycare if I'm positive. So, you know, does Marshfield or do any other health systems have any plans in place to help their caregivers, you know, to cope with a situation like that?
Dr. Melms, what can you say to that situation?
Yes, it's an excellent question, and it's a difficult one to answer. We have been doing what we feel that we can to provide help for our employees who are parents of with children, whether they are sick or exposed, or their kids are sick or exposed. Not easy answers. You know, we have had early in the pandemic, we had some daycare situations we were looking at. Making connections between some of our families who have kids, for instance, that were in high school or in college and were home, and making the connections between our employees and those kids. We had a kind of a volunteer board up that has worked to a certain extent, but there are really no good answers for this, because the personnel is just simply not available to provide that assistance and that care. So we have had, this is what contributes to our 15% of our work staff home, is many of those are at home taking care of their kids.
Melissa, thank you for working in the ER, and thanks for calling in. Patty is with us now in Appleton. Patty, hi. What is the situation where you are?
Yes, good morning. I'm a laboratory manager for two critical access hospitals with ThetaCare, and you know, we have the supply issues that we're constantly chasing to get the test in that we need. So that's one front. But besides staff being out with COVID, we also have a shortage of medical technology programs and students coming out. So we're seeing a double crunch in, you know, having to battle this disease, but also, you know, work with staffing crunches. So from a laboratory perspective, we do everything we possibly can, from frontline workers to behind the scenes to, you know, just helping the whole system manage through this supply chain issues.
So supply chain, meaning not, you know, you're trying to graduate more workers into the field, into lab work, but also are you finding you have enough supplies themselves, enough PPE, for instance?
PPE, we're good on, you know, we rely on the health system, and they've done a very good job managing that. It's, you know, the testing supplies we need, but also other supplies that we need might have back orders per se, because just of the raw supplies needed, could be microbiology supplies. So for laboratorians, this is a new territory, and every day is just managing both of those fronts, along with taking care of our patients.
Yeah, thank you. Dr. Melms, what is the situation like with supplies where you are, your system, with PPE and other supplies?
Yeah, first, I appreciate Patty's comments. I know in Appleton, in that area, they're on the leading edge as Wisconsin started to surge. We have been doing pretty well with PPE supplies compared to early in the pandemic. We source supplies everywhere we possibly can. And that has been certainly much easier than sourcing personnel. Lab has been another challenge. We have been performing approximately 12,000 tests per week in our lab. And what happens is as we perform more tests, the turnaround for those tests, the results tends to or does get greater and greater. And the longer the turnaround time, the less valid the test is, because things can change between the time that we obtain the sample then and the time that we result it. That is certainly another additional challenge that we faced.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Melms of Marshfield Clinic Health System. He's a family practice physician and chief medical officer, taking your calls and questions on COVID and the situation where you are, especially if you're a frontline worker. 800-642-1234. Wesley is joining us from Fall River this morning. Hi, Wesley.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead with your question.
So if you get COVID and you get better, so then you have created antibodies, are you immune to it, or do you end up getting the COVID after, say, 6 months or even 3 months?
Yeah, Dr. Melms, what is the latest research on that?
Yeah, so an excellent question, and we certainly hope you're immune to it. But we haven't been doing this long enough to be able to tell with a great deal of certainty. We know that if we do a test on you and we see antibodies to the spike protein of the virus, we believe that that is protective for about 5 or 6 months. And then beyond that point, we just don't know yet.
Wesley, does that make sense?
It does. But then also there was talk about if you was to get the vaccine, that it would only be good for a 3 month period, and then you could be able to get sick again.
There again, we don't have enough information yet. That will take much greater experience with vaccine once we have vaccine available to determine how long the immunity will be. We know that it'll be a two-shot series, whichever manufacturer sort of wins the race on this, but we don't know how long that immunity will last.
Wesley, thanks for those questions. We heard from Amanda in Milwaukee, who had actually called in yesterday and wanted to share. She's a frontline worker, and patients are coming in with pending test results and not being honest about waiting for those test results. And Amanda says this is a concern she has, because some people end up testing positive. And she says people shouldn't be going out in public if they're awaiting test results. Can you speak to the issue of quarantining?
Yeah, well, that's one of the big problems in our state, and I'm sure everywhere at this point, is that when people are told to quarantine, if somebody is symptomatic and we do a test on them, we ask them, public health officials ask them to quarantine until those results come back. But we're seeing really poor compliance in many cases with that, and that's incredibly unfortunate, and it is contributing to the spread of this illness.
Governor Evers has asked the state to stay home in a statewide address this week. He stopped short of issuing new orders to close schools or businesses. But what actions, what policies do you want to see from the state in this situation?
Well, I believe Governor Evers has done everything he possibly can. And we truly need something that's not just simply a governor's executive order, because as we've seen, that gets struck down. We need legislative action. I'd love to see the governor and the legislators work together to come up with policy that could stick and be effective. Truly, with the rate of increased positives that we have, with the demands on our healthcare system, our hospitals are going to be overrun. We need to have a lockdown in the state. We truly need to go into a safer at home order for about 14 days to cool things off.
And mask wearing.
Mask wearing, absolutely mask wearing.
How optimistic are you about the Pfizer vaccine or the other vaccines in production in trial now?
I was thrilled to hear the Pfizer preliminary results. If we can have a vaccine that has 90% efficacy, if they can make enough of it, if we can get it distributed, if we can have the cold storage available, that is the path to being past this pandemic.
What does your day look like today? What are you faced with in your job?
Well, my day is like every other day. It started a few hours ago. and it will go until about 11 o'clock tonight. There is lots to do. We have a lot to do to direct the pandemic, to direct our response to the pandemic across our 9 systems. I have to say that I'm extremely fortunate to work with tremendously dedicated individuals, those that direct and run our hospitals, and those that see patients on the front line.
Dr. Melms, thank you for joining us. Thank you for your work.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Dr. Bill Melms is Chief Medical Officer for Marshfield Clinic Health System. Coming up, we look at the future of the Affordable Care Act as the Supreme Court hears a challenge to it. More than 23 million Americans are currently covered under the ACA, and that conversation is after a news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. The Supreme Court heard arguments this week in a case challenging the health care law. We're discussing the future of the Affordable Care Act here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Over the past decade, health insurance markets have been reshaped. Open enrollment season is underway for the ACA. At the start of Governor Evers' pandemic briefing yesterday, he urged residents to get coverage.
The deadline to sign up is December 15th, so don't wait. Visit wiscovered.com or call 211 today, because now more than ever, your health care matters.
How has the ACA helped or hurt you? What do you want the high court to do? We're at 800-642-1234. William Park Sutherland is a health policy engagement coordinator with Kids Forward. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit statewide policy center advocating for effective solutions that break down barriers to success for children and families. William, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much, Kate.
So the High Court heard oral arguments Tuesday on the ACA. What were you listening for?
You know, I was listening for whether or not there would be a majority of justices who seem skeptical of whether or not the individual mandate, which is the requirement that you have health insurance, would be connected to the rest of the law and whether or not it could be struck down. So,
The word was severability. That there is a lot of that word severable. The idea, if the court strikes down the mandate, the rest of the law could stay in place if the justices decide it's severable.
Right. Yeah. And a majority of the justices seem pretty skeptical that even if the individual mandate were declared unconstitutional, that the rest of the law would have to be struck down as well. So they were skeptical about that severability argument.
What else did you hear in those 2 hours?
The attorneys for the 21 states that are defending the Affordable Care Act spent a fair amount of time, especially in their opening and closing arguments, talking about the benefits of the ACA, talking about the millions of people who got access to health insurance because of the Affordable Care Act, talked about some of the protections that many people know, like protecting people with pre-existing conditions. And they talked about the shock that would happen to the health insurance system if the Supreme Court were to strike down the majority of the Affordable Care Act or major portions of the Affordable Care Act.
Your organization, Kids Forward, has a report, came out last month, looking at the ACA's impact in Wisconsin. What have you found here in our state?
So the federally facilitated marketplace, or healthcare.gov, makes it easier to shop for insurance. You can sort of compare prices and plans. About 200,000 Wisconsinites get their health coverage through healthcare.gov. About 8 of 10 of those people get financial assistance to help pay for their premiums. Those are also called the tax credits. And generally speaking, people in rural counties have higher rates of enrollment than those in more urban or suburban counties, and the prices for insurance tend to be higher in those rural areas, and so they qualify for larger discounts. And so in some ways, the Affordable Care Act is, at least that piece of the Affordable Care Act is, you know, is more important or is especially important in rural areas. You know, another benefit that we have because of the Affordable Care Act is it allows kids to stay on their parents' health insurance plan until age 26.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2017, about 41,000 young adults in Wisconsin benefited from that. It sort of famously protects people with pre-existing conditions. The latest estimates from the Kaiser Family Foundation find that about 890,000 people in Wisconsin who are under the age of 65 have at least one pre-existing health condition that might bar them from health insurance.
Let me reintroduce you here for a moment, talking about the future of the ACA with Will Park Sutherland from Kids Forward, where Will specializes in health policy. We're looking at the high court's challenge here to the ACA and what the Supreme Court will do. Open enrollment is underway for the ACA. Have you enrolled in a plan for next year? What was the process like? What have you seen through the healthcare law over its past decade? Join in 800-642-1234. And Will, I want to pose that to you. What have you seen through this healthcare law over the past decade? What have you seen it do?
So, you know, one of the things that's happened is millions and millions of people have gotten coverage who weren't able to get coverage before. The ACA has expanded coverage to people of color who've been uninsured or who have been insured significantly higher rates because of the Affordable Care Act since 2013 and 2014. There still are really substantial disparities in access to health insurance. So, you know, white Wisconsinites still have a higher health insurance rate than Latinx and Native American and Black residents. But that gap was narrowed significantly. Generally speaking, in states that have fully expanded their Medicaid programs, which is health insurance for elderly and low-income folks and people with disabilities, they have seen a greater coverage increases for everyone, including people of color. The Affordable Care Act has also, you know, just sort of increased the amount of people who don't have to worry about annual or lifetime limits on care. Before the Affordable Care Act, you know, some people who require significant amounts of care could end up running into a lifetime limit of maybe $1 million, which sounds like, you know, a ton of money. But I was on a conference call with somebody who got into a serious car accident and within a few weeks had already run up against that lifetime limit if it wasn't for the Affordable Care Act. So those are a couple things that have, you know, changed the landscape over the years.
Wisconsin hasn't taken the expansion of Medicaid, of the federal expansion. Can you explain why and the a little bit more context there?
Sure. So, well, I guess the first thing to say is that, you know, Wisconsin would be doing better if it had fully expanded Medicaid, or Badger Care, as it's better known in our state. In April of 2014, the state expanded Badger Care partially to everyone below 100% of the federal poverty level. But that really doesn't tell the whole story. For one, the poverty level is simply too low. So for instance, a single mom with one kid who's working a full-time job that pays about $8.29 an hour makes too much money to qualify for Badger Care.
Mm.
I'm a single adult who's working a full-time minimum wage job. They also would make too much money to qualify under the current rules. The other thing is, because we didn't fully expand, we didn't qualify for enhanced federal funding that was available through the Affordable Care Act. And so we've been, since April of 2014, we've spent about $1.3 billion that we didn't need to spend to cover these people. And so if we fully expanded Medicaid right now, the Department of Health Services estimates that we would cover about 95,000 additional people who would have access to Badger Care, and that the state would save a little less than $300 million in state revenue per year.
When you, going back to pre-existing conditions, when you look at issues running up into lifetime limits, in the scenario where the ACA is struck down, what does that do to people with pre-existing conditions? Where are they left?
Yeah, so, it takes us back to some of the bad old days of insurance where you might be locked into a job that, gives you health insurance coverage right now, but that you couldn't risk, maybe starting your own business or becoming a freelancer because you might not be able to get health insurance to cover your costs. I think another thing that happened that actually happened to me right before the Affordable Care Act is insurance companies could have waiting periods. So they might say, we'll cover this issue with your eyes, but we won't do that for a year. We won't do that for 6 months. And so you have health insurance, but you can't use it for some of these things, for 6 months or a year. So there's sort of a number of different ways that people could be vulnerable. And then some people just might not be able to get insurance at all, or the insurance that they're offered might simply be completely unaffordable.
We're discussing what the future holds for the health care law with William Park Sutherland. He works on health policy at Kids Forward. Do you have a pre-existing condition? How has that affected your ability to get coverage? Did you enroll in an ACA plan for next year? What was that process like? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with William Park Sutherland here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at healthcare coverage in America and a case before the Supreme Court challenging the Affordable Care Act. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The ACA has remained in place for a decade, as we've been talking about. More than 23 million Americans depend on the law for their healthcare. A controversial part of the law is the requirement that people either buy health insurance or pay a penalty. That's the individual mandate. Should the ACA be struck down in whole or part? How do you feel about it during the pandemic as hospitals are overrun with patients in need of urgent care? It's 800-642-1234. William Park Sutherland works on health policy at Kids Forward, and he's with us for 10 more minutes. Let's take a call on this now. Cindy is joining us from Appleton this morning. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. Well, I'll tell you, the ACA has been a godsend for me. I retired at the age of 63 and a half. I did not want to have to work till I was 65. My benefits from work to cover insurance would have been $445 a month. The ACA with a very comparable plan that I have right now to what I had is $41.22 a month. That is a huge difference, and I only have to do this for a year and a half until I can get onto the Medicare. But I don't know what I would have done without the ACA. I guess I would not have been able to retire, and I think that's that's a sad thing that people can't retire because of health insurance.
Cindy, thank you for sharing your situation. William, $41.22. Cindy says very affordable, and she wouldn't know what she would do without the marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, that's another piece of the sort of idea of job lock, that you know, you have to stay on your, you know, employer-sponsored plan if you, before you could get to Medicare. So there are a number of people who now can retire a little earlier, like Cindy, because they can purchase, more easily purchase and more affordably purchase health insurance through the healthcare.gov.
As you see us facing these, this COVID crisis, this global pandemic, and what is happening here in Wisconsin, hospitals full, what does the ACA mean in the face of COVID-19?
No, I think health insurance right now is more important than ever. And, you know, we've seen millions of people across the country who have lost their jobs. And because our system ties, you know, insurance to your employment rather than to your humanity, those people have also lost their health insurance. And, you know, the Affordable Care Act is available for people who lose their job-based coverage. You know, they can apply regardless of an open enrollment period. They can apply to get coverage for a certain amount of time. You know, the current administration hasn't been very good about advertising that, but that is definitely one of the benefits of having the Affordable Care Act. I mean, the other is just the importance of having as many people as possible have comprehensive health insurance, especially during a pandemic, is really important to make sure people can get tested, can get treatment, and can, you know, take care of themselves as best they can.
We're talking,
also,
go ahead.
You know, COVID-19 might very well become a pre-existing condition. And so we might have even more people who, you know, would have deniable health conditions without the Affordable Care Act.
William Park Sutherland is a health policy engagement coordinator with Kids Forward. We're discussing the future of the ACA, the healthcare law that's been in place for a decade. Let's bring in Randy now in Sussex. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. I have a question. If you can't make, if the Affordable Health Care and the Supreme Court concludes that you can't force people to buy insurance, would that affect all insurance, including automobile insurance?
Okay. And I think you were breaking up just a little bit. If the Supreme Court says that it's the individual mandate is unconstitutional, does that affect other types of insurance, William?
So the short answer right now is no. You know, this case is merely about whether or not you can be compelled to buy health insurance. And this sort of all comes from Congress passing in 2017 a tax cut. I think the Tax Cut and Jobs Act is what it was called, where they zeroed out the penalty for not having health insurance. And so the mandate was sort of allowed to stay because it was read as a choice. You can either buy health insurance or you can pay a tax. And now that the tax is zero, sort of the argument is, well, now there's only a requirement to buy health insurance, and that requirement is unconstitutional. And if that were struck down, one, it might just be struck down by itself, and none of the other pieces of the health law would be affected. And it wouldn't affect any other requirement to buy car insurance or homeowners insurance or any other requirement that the federal government or the state government mandates.
Randy, thanks. Let's bring in Paula now from La Crosse. Hi, Paula.
Hi. Yeah, this is Paula. I just want to make two comments, and actually your guest that's what I don't understand. I've been in healthcare for over 35 years, and when the Affordable Care Act came about, there's 2 points. Yeah. Do people value their car more than their own health and their fellow community members' health? You have to have insurance on if you own a car. And then the other thing the Affordable Care Act did, we were able to keep our sons on our health insurance plan until they were 26. And my son, when he got off of our plan, was able to get a good plan for approximately $100 a month.
Paula, thank you for sharing that situation. And Paula seeing that keeping her son on and the ability to do that until age 26 was certainly a great benefit in ensuring that her son was covered until he could get on his own plan.
Yeah, I was just talking to somebody the other day who said they were able to start their career as a freelancer because they were able to stay on their parents' health insurance plan, and that if they had to, you know, figure out how to have health insurance on their own, they wouldn't have had that flexibility.
You were among 33 people recently appointed to the Governor's Health Equity Council looking to address health disparities. What do you want to achieve out of this work, out of this council?
Like I said earlier, you know, our state has tremendous disparities and inequities in coverage, in access to health insurance, and access to health care, and then in healthcare outcomes. And, you know, health insurance is just one of the many pieces that need to change for us to address the systemic racism that is, you know, embedded in many pieces of our health insurance system and our health care system. And, you know, I would like to see us having, and I see us starting to do this anyways, but having more honest conversations about what kind of changes we need to make, both in the health insurance system and in the healthcare system.
And it sounds like
that's just for those things. I mean, there's social determinants of health, like where you live and transportation and housing, which, you know, affect health more than they have than health care.
Yes, so many determinations there. William, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
William Park Sutherland is a health policy engagement coordinator with Kids Forward, and it's a nonprofit statewide policy center advocating for solutions that break down barriers for children and families. Just ahead, we talk with American University presidential historian Alan Lichtman will be here. He has successfully called every election since 1984. We take stock of 2020. We'll circle back with Lichtman and his predictions keys, his 13 keys. You have a line to him, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.